You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Minutes after 8 o'clock on a Wednesday. Mike McNamara with you. I'm joined again by former Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Beth Harvey. Beth, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm all right. All right. How's life as a retired Marine, mom, lawyer?
It's good.
Is it?
That's just good. It's busy. Yeah.
Do you like raising kids?
I like raising my kids.
There you
most
go.
Most of the time. They're old enough to be at school and other places long enough for the day that it can be enjoyable.
Right. No, you know what? I always thought I love raising kids, and it doesn't get easier as they get older and they don't need you less, which is was a shock to me. I thought in my mind's eye, that, you know, once they, you know, kind of once they grew up, like they went, you know, like what are they going to come around for? To, you know, to eat a steak and to have dinner and things like that. But it turns out it's not that way. that they look for counsel and their problems get bigger and they get more complicated. And I thought, what is this? I'm still parenting?
Yeah, I think it's nice that my teenager still comes home and tells me about her day, so. I will certainly take that for as long as that lasts.
Right. All right, let's give everybody the 5-minute rehash of your biography. So, born and raised where?
All over, military brat, Marine Corps brat. So, majority of the time was probably out here in California, but also with high school, Lejeune,
yikes.
Other various places.
How much did you hate Lejeune?
You know, I didn't mind it.
Come on, tell the
kid.
Truth. Tell the truth. No need to come on All Marine Radio and just start spinning fables. You lived in California and you liked North Carolina with all the bugs and the humidity. Come on.
Well, what I liked was that it was the only time really that we lived on base, and all of my friends lived on the same street as me. So, I mean, you know, we're all basically right there. Everybody went to high school with, and so that was nice. And there's, you know, fun things for kids to do on base. I didn't have to go out and, I mean, yeah, I was back there for motor cheese school later, and it was less fun as a, you know, adult looking for stuff to do, but as a teenager, not too bad.
Jacksonville, a bit challenging for entertainment. All right. Talk to us about, so first of all, so what did your, was it your dad in the Marine Corps, your mom, both?
My dad was in the Marine Corps.
What did he do for a living?
Well, he started out as air support in Vietnam, and then he went to law school and was a lawyer for the rest of his career as well.
So you're a legacy like Kent Dorfman. Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
So where do you go to college, and when do you kind of decide that the Marine Corps might not be a bad place to have a career?
Well, I wanted to go to the University of Notre Dame, and so I needed to find a way to pay for it. So I started looking at ROTC scholarships. I actually ended up with a Navy ROTC scholarship, and that's what I went to school on. But then after my first year, I decided that I would prefer to go into the Marine Corps instead of the Navy. So I switched programs and ended up with a Marine Corps scholarship for the rest of my time.
Wow, so you not only got into Notre Dame, so you must be a smart human being, yes? How did you finagle the, were you a great writer in terms of getting scholarships, or how did the scholarship thing work?
Well, the Navy one, actually, it was kind of funny because the guidance counselor at my high school screwed it up, and I actually missed the deadline for the application. And, you know, they're supposed to set up an interview for you with a Navy officer. And so in trying to scramble and get everything in, they're like, well, do you know any Navy officers? And my best friend's dad was a captain. So I went and interviewed with him, which was really pretty easy, pretty comfortable. And so I think that probably helped. But
so you had you had the inside hook. We love that.
Yeah.
We love that. Okay. And then big deal to change from Navy to Marine Corps in college?
It was actually, it's just a long process. And the Navy requires you to take some classes that I quickly realized were not my strengths, like physics and calculus. And so I had to suffer through those while I was waiting for the, you know, to be accepted for the Marine Corps scholarship. So that was a, it was something I wished I had figured out earlier.
Yeah, the Marine Corps, you can go to those poli-sci and history classes. We'll still take you. The Navy wants those, wants the crazy classes. I'm out.
Yeah.
All right. So, so then, so at what point, do you decide that professionally this is probably what I, something I want to do? High school?
The Marine Corps or the, well, initially, you know, it started out as a way to pay for college.
Right.
It was familiar to be, to me. My dad had gone to ROTC, and obviously, when I started college, my dad was still in the Marine Corps. So, the military in general was pretty familiar to me, and I liked the idea of it, and I liked the idea of not paying for a college I wouldn't otherwise be able to probably attend. And so, then once I was in and, you know, finished my initial commitment, it was, you know, I liked the Marine Corps, and then they sent me to law school. So Marine Corps continued to provide me with a lot of opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise had, or at least not come out of without significant debt.
I want to ask you a professional question, a professional female Marine question. I had a captain by the name of Lauren Serrano on, I don't know, a month or two, no, longer than that, maybe 3 months ago. And she wrote an article recently in the Gazette talking about the, you know, I joined the Marine Corps. I'm a woman. I joined the Marine Corps. I thought the Marine Corps was interested in my contribution, but it seems to me now that the Marine Corps wants me to kind of be a guy. Well, I don't want to be a guy. I don't want to be a grunt. And yet, you're changing the physical fitness requirements. My evaluation certainly will be changed. I've just had two children. Do you still want me? Have you heard that art, that that discussion before? And I'm curious about your thoughts on it.
I'm not familiar with the article, but I'm certainly familiar with that line of thought. And you know, like I said, my dad was in the Marine Corps, so initially the reason I went Navy instead of Marine Corps was because I just had sort of a very uninformed view of the Marine Corps as a place that would be difficult for women and, you know, be easier to be in the Navy as a woman, that kind of thing. When I decided to switch over, just because I liked being around Marines, and I liked doing things Marines do, you know, I talked to my dad about it, and he had worked with a number of female officers, and he said that, you know, some of the best that he ever worked with were ones who weren't ashamed of being women or weren't afraid to be women or feminine. They weren't trying to be a man or trying to prove anything to the men other than their own competence in their job. And that sort of was my perspective on it as well, was that I tried to do my job as well as I could and be considered an equal. I mean, and it's also, I think, maybe a little easier once you get into the legal community because most of what you do is mental, and that's, you know, a lot easier to be considered equal in those terms than maybe some more physical jobs. But even when I was a motor transport officer, I never, you know, I was pretty good at PT, and I could take my Marines out and and run them pretty hard, and we could, yeah, I never felt like there was something that I was lacking in that way because I was a woman, but I was also never trying to prove myself, you know, as physically capable of, you know, I worked with a guy who played football for the Steelers before he came to the Marine Corps. Like, we were not the same, and I tried to be the same as him in physical type things. Obviously, it wouldn't have worked out, but I don't remember ever having that need or worrying about that. So I understand that perspective on that article, and I think I would probably agree with it. I remember seeing something a few years ago where the last Secretary of the Navy made some comments about uniformity in the uniforms and not wanting to be able to tell whether it's a man or a woman from, like, behind. And I thought, well, what's so bad about being a woman? Why is that important? And so I guess in that respect, I agree with that article.
Yeah, it's almost like the services are groping for groping in the sense of kind of in the dark, and you're unsure of where this point is, but searching, groping for this happy medium between, you know, some women who want to live in the world of combat arms, where many would argue that there ought to be a single standard and ought to be the male standard, and then others who say, I don't want to do that. So why would you hold me to a different standard? I'm okay with the female standards that the Marine Corps currently embraces. I don't want to be anything else. So I don't, you know, it's interesting institutionally to watch, how do we figure this out? You know, how do we make it, how do we make it fair to everybody?
Right. And, you know, and they have, you know, I know, considered and looked at what, you know, functional fitness as far as tied to your MOS as opposed to
your
gender or your age or whatever. And, you know, that to me seems probably more closer to the right fit, where, you know, the people, you know, the admin Marines don't necessarily need to have all of the same capabilities that the infantry Marines do. Regardless of gender, it's something along those lines. But again, it's difficult because we're also a service that, you know, every Marine's a rifleman. So then how do you, you know, everyone's supposed to be able to do everything that everybody can do. So, you know, and that makes it also more difficult.
Yeah. Does that mean that's not true?
Right. It's not true. Right.
Well,
certainly.
Know,
nobody would have sent me out with an infantry battalion or something.
Yeah, we that are infantrymen, we know that that's not true, okay? Just like every Marine's not an SJA and every Marine's not a motor transport operator, okay? But it's a saying in the Marine Corps that we like, but it does mean that there's a minimum set of standards that we expect everybody to be able to live up to. And when you have to grab your rifle and go, you're not supposed to be reluctant about doing that and carrying your share of the weight. But now we're caught up in all that. And institutionally, you know, how do you live in this world that's supposed to be genderless, you know, and it's still answer all the things you're supposed to answer to. So interesting discussion. I want to transition, before we talk about the Navy and their decision to charge a couple of skippers and kind of the background of that and the criteria for that and a little bit of the history. Marine Corps has gone down a road charges that stem from the incidents at Parris Island. Did you ever do any work on the drill fields?
I did not. My husband was assigned to the drill field both as a series officer and then later as a judge advocate. But so just through observing him, but no, I've never been to the drill field myself.
The decision for the Marine Corps, it's not uncommon to see staff NCOs, officers charged with some crime in connection with negligence that surrounds a death, is it?
No, I mean, negligence, supposing you meet the standards, is, yeah, it can be a, there could be criminal negligence, and certainly when it results in death, then yeah, that that should be examined, and if there's criminal liability there, then it should be exercised.
Or have you followed the trials at Parris Island?
Not the trial so much. I remember when the investigation first, you know, was going on, and kind of familiar with some of it. And I've seen some of the headlines about the, you know, the drill instructors, they headed towards trial, specifically as it relates to, you know, the putting the recruits in the dryer and things like that.
Right. Yeah, and he specifically was charged with abusive recruits, and was sentenced ultimately to 10 years in prison.
Oh yeah.
So these things aren't atypical, and
no, that I've seen a lot of drill instructor cases as a judge with NCRD here. They're usually not that severe, the abuse that's alleged, right. But that is something that that is not uncommon.
All right, let's talk about the first of all, is there any difference between the way the Navy would approach this and the way the Marine Corps approaches this? I mean, I don't know that you get higher profile cases than the Navy's dealing with right now. Is there any difference in terms of the way they handle these things?
No, the Navy and Marine Corps operate the same under as far as our military justice, where the judiciary is combined, up at the appellate level, it's one office, Navy and Marine Corps. The Court of Criminal Appeals is both Navy and Marine Corps. So, even though we operate under the same uniform code of military justice as the Army and the Air Force, there are some slight differences in those services and procedurally and things, but the Navy and Marine Corps are aligned.
Okay. What's the biggest difference procedurally?
Between the Air Force and the Army and the Marine Corps?
Yeah.
You know, it's nothing real significant, but things like just the manner in how they charge cases, like who the person is that they have sign off on it. Or prior to some of the changes that were made to Article 32 hearings a few years ago, they had some differences in how they ran those. It, things like that. There's some different case law that comes out of their appellate court than ours. But nothing real significant, more of just, you know, some quirks that exist or minor differences that will naturally develop differently in different services.
All right. I'm going to read you a little bit of an editorial that was written yesterday. It appeared in Navy Times, and the headline is "The Navy's Dicey Decision to Pursue Homicide Charges," and I want to get your thoughts on it. The Navy took a stunning and historic measure on January 16th by charging two commanding officers with negligent homicide in the two ship collisions last summer. This is no longer just a Navy issue. It's a move that will have a potentially far-reaching impact on all services and service members up and down the chain of command. It raises the unsettling question about the scope and limitations of a commander's responsibilities, and it sets the stage for one of the most consequential uniform code of military justice proceedings in generations. 17 sailors died in those mishaps involving the destroyers Fitzgerald and John S. McCain, and the need for accountability is an urgent one. Based on public reports on the Navy investigation, both men deserve punishment. But in choosing such severe criminal penalty criminal charge, the Navy is stepping in onto a slippery slope. To be sure, there is sound logic to dropping the hammer on these two officers, especially in the Navy's culture, quote, a skipper's responsibility for his or her ship is absolute, and aggressive criminal prosecution will reinforce that, and the families who continue to mourn the loss of 17 sailors reserve some redress. But it goes on to say the Navy's in uncharted waters now. There is no obvious historical precedent for a negligent homicide prosecution for an officer discharging his official duties, however negligently. a captain of a U.S. Navy destroyer was court-martialed in 1980 in a 1989 collision that killed one sailor and injured 17, but his charge was dereliction of duty. He was ultimately not convicted. The Navy is taking a big risk here. Talk to us about this, Beth. How is this normally charged? Is dereliction of duty the normal charge that you see in these kind of cases? And is this a slippery slope? And is this a bridge? Is this a reach for the prosecution?
Yeah, it is interesting because when I was kind of looking at some of the history of these types of cases, they are generally addressed as just a dereliction of duty, which is just, you know, a negligent action or failure to act when you have a duty to do so. And that seems to be the more normal course. Now, you know, part of the problem here is that everybody hasn't seen everything that the Navy has. I don't know what they have that makes them think it's elevated beyond that, but yeah, it is unusual. As far as the slippery slope, I don't know about that. I don't know what I don't know what the escalation is or where the slope goes that this causes a problem. I mean, I know that the editorial and some of the other things I've seen are concerned that COs will be hesitant to take action if they feel like there's going to be criminal liability. But, you could say that about a lot of different things. As far as the negligent homicide charges, though, it does seem to be unusual and will certainly be interesting as we get to the preliminary hearings to see what evidence the Navy has that they think ties the negligence they believe they've found to the causes of the death. I mean, that's the most difficult part of the negligent homicide charge here is that you have to show that the action or failure to act must be the proximate cause of death, meaning that the death of these sailors has to have been the natural and probable result of the accused's negligence.
Okay. The editorial goes on in terms of kind of outlining the risk here. Will these criminal charges discourage future leaders from seeking command? Will this make commanders more risk averse when making the split second decision, life or death decisions that they might face? Will this hurt morale if sailors view this as a politically motivated decision by admirals seeking to appease their critics? So those are the questions. I don't know. Will it, just my opinion, will these criminal charges discourage future leaders from seeking command? No. Will this make commanders more risk averse when making split second decision or life or death decisions that they might face? I would say absolutely not. My impression is it will make them more conscious of their preparations, the readiness of their crews to undertake going to sea and pay more attention to that. That would be my takeaway from it, from just what I've seen, and I haven't seen everything. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, from reading what I've read, none of this has to do with split second decision.
Right.
This is a failure to train, a failure to, or what it seems to be is, a failure to follow procedures and safety precautions, and that usually is a result of lack of supervision, lack of training, lack of leadership. So if it causes COs to be more conscious of those things, that doesn't seem so bad.
No, it doesn't. Will this hurt morale if sailors view this as a politically motivated decision by admirals seeking to appease their critics? I want to ask you about the decision, how this decision got arrived at. Because to me, if this thing goes to court-martial and under these charges and they're acquitted, it further sullies the reputation of the United States Navy. They cannot afford institutionally, in my opinion, a loss. And so talk to me, take me inside of a room where you, as an SJA, acting as what I would call a district attorney, whoever that is, sits down with, you know, your, whoever's working for you with, NCIS and sits down to talk about what charges do we level in the wake of seven sailors getting killed in one incident and 10 sailors killed in another incident. Do they merit the same charges? Walk us through that, if you would. How do you do that?
Well, the investigation obviously has to be done first, and there may be some recommendation depending on how they did the investigation. Sometimes if it's a big one like this, they probably had a legal advisor, so there probably was an attorney involved in the investigation who provided, assisted in providing the recommendation from the investigating officer to what types of charges might be appropriate. Who knows what they put in there? I'm sure at least the dereliction, the hazarding a vessel. But then it moves beyond that to, the Navy appointed in these two cases a consolidated disposition authority. So they have one admiral who is in charge of both of these cases.
Okay.
And both of all the cases, administrative or criminal, that could result from these two crashes, incidents.
Okay.
And so that person has a staff judge advocate and attorneys on staff, and they, I'm sure, have spent a lot of time talking to probably people pretty high up in the Navy trial. Their prosecutors are sort of in their consolidated office within the Navy and within the Navy JAG Corps. And so probably some conversations with the admiral who's in charge of that and those lawyers as to what charges would be appropriate. And then ultimately, the decision hasn't been made yet necessarily by the admiral to go forward to trial on these charges. Right now, they're going to be investigated at the preliminary hearing, so they may or may not move forward from there. But at this point, there's at least attorneys who have they have an ethical duty not to charge anything that they don't believe there's a basis in law and fact to charge. So there's something in that investigation that has led these attorneys to believe that this charge is appropriate for both of these cases, and so it has been charged. It's been charged at this point, and then it'll be investigated at an Article 32 hearing to determine whether or not it actually goes to trial with these charges.
So now, who sits at the Article 32 and evaluates all of this?
Well, it's a judge advocate, and they have changed primarily because of the sexual assault cases and everything that's come about as far as changing the military justice system to better serve those types of cases. There have been a lot of changes to the Article 32. It used to be more of a freewheeling, brought in a lot of people, asked a lot of questions, and kind of acted as the way for the defense in particular to learn a lot about the government's case and pin witnesses down to certain statements and things like that. It's very restricted in scope from that now, but the idea is that there is an impartial judge advocate who will look at the evidence and determine whether or not probable cause exists for each of these charges and give a recommendation as to how the charges, whether they should move forward and how they should, or how they should be disposed of. It's just a recommendation. The convening authority, ultimately the admiral, back to this consolidated disposition authority. He'll ultimately, with the advice of his SJA, make the decision as to what he's going to do moving forward with each of these cases. And it's not just the COs. You've got some other officers charged, at least on the Fitzgerald.
On the Fitzgerald, yeah.
I think the
officer of the deck and the junior and one junior officer of the deck are both charged on the Fitzgerald.
Right, and so then I think I saw somebody said they were looking at potentially, a chief, and I think on the McCain, and then they've got some administrative proceedings with some people as well. So, you know, NJP, I assume is what they mean.
Just so I have this straight, so at the Article 32, there will be, the case will be laid out for these specific negligent homicide charges, which, again, by all accounts, it's a more aggressive charge. As I sat down before we charge this, before we go to the Article 32, and I am the, what's a one-star admiral? Vice admiral? Come on, you're in Navy ROTC. What's that guy's
rear admiral lower half.
Okay, yeah, what a rear admiral lower half? They have a,
and then upper half, then vice admiral, then admiral, if I remember correctly.
All right, we'll take your word for it. Okay, so rear admiral lower half. That doesn't sound good. Yeah. That doesn't sound right. I don't know that I would at least want upper half. So anyway, that guy or girl, that they look at those charges, the evidence they have that would cause them in such a high profile case to take such an aggressive position must be substantial, yes? Or because again, when we charge this out, again, the Navy's credibility has taken a bunch of hit. The last thing we need to do is to turn this trial, these trials, into shit shows and show that we're not capable of charging this appropriately, prosecuting this appropriately, and we sully our reputation further. Is that a consideration?
I'm sure that is a consideration, that that if you put this on the charge sheet and you fail to get anywhere with it, how does that turn out? How does that look? That being said, though, again, we're at the stage where this is going to be investigated at the preliminary hearing. So they believe that there's evidence to merit the charge, but they get a further chance to really make the ultimate decision as to whether or not that's going to go to trial after the Article 32. So, in that forum, the defense will have the opportunity to put on some evidence as well that may or may not change that evaluation.
I've got an email for you. Mm-hmm. Mac, a question about the Article 32. What happens if the presiding judge looks at the evidence and says, yeah, that doesn't cut it? Then what?
Well, so they provide a report. The Article 32 preliminary hearing officer provides a report to the convening authority,
right,
that says, I don't think this cuts it for these reasons. And it happens a lot, especially in, again, going back to some of the sexual assault or other sex charges, and it can be based on, I don't think you're going to get a conviction versus, I don't think that the charge is merited. That I don't think there's probable cause to support this charge. The recommendation is a recommendation. So then it goes to the convening authority, and ultimately they don't have to follow that. They don't have to follow that recommendation. So if the convening authority believes it's still, he still believes that there's probable cause and that it should go forward, then he can send it to court martial, no matter what the preliminary hearing officer recommended.
Okay. And then will he advise that the charges be modified, or will he not advise?
You could do that. The preliminary hearing officer can make a bunch of different recommendations as to the form of the charges, as to whether or not there's probable cause for the charges, as to what the ultimate disposition of the charge should be, all of those types. So, obviously in other cases, there could be a different varying levels of outcomes. This one, if you think that negligent homicide is appropriate, then obviously it's going to go to a general court martial. It's not going to go, to something lesser, but all of those things are wrapped up into the recommendation that the preliminary hearing officer provides.
All right. The, another email for you. Matt, could you ask Beth to reconnect the negligent homicide thing? Is this a pretty tall burden for the prosecution? Because I, too, believe that the Navy has no room to screw this up. That one of the things they have to do is restore confidence in the United States Navy. And the way they handle this will be on display for everybody. So I think it's important that they get it right, that they charge it right, that they prosecute it right, that they do it right. Because they don't need another punch in the nose.
It is a tall burden. Obviously, it's a criminal proceeding, so anything that's charged has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The burden is entirely on the government to prove the case. Defense has no burden at all, and it has to be proven beyond reasonable doubt, which is an incredibly high hurdle to get across. So I've pulled up, I'm actually looking at the jury instructions that pertain to negligent homicide for some of the definitions and things. So the elements, every crime is broken out down into elements, meaning, you know, portions of it, each of which must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Negligent homicide, the elements are, one, that there is somebody who has died. Two, that death resulted from the action or failure to act of the accused. And then there's some action or failure to act that will be alleged in the charge. Three, that the killing by the accused was unlawful. Four, that the action or failure to act of the accused which caused the death amounted to simple negligence. And five, that under the circumstances, the conduct of the accused was either to the prejudice of good order and discipline of the armed forces, or the nature of bring discredit upon the armed forces. So the big ones here, the ones that are the most focus will be on here, would be the action or failure to act was simple negligence, which isn't really difficult to get to, but more importantly, that the death resulted from this action or failure to act. So simple negligence is basically if a person has a duty to use due care, and their actions or failures to act show a lack of that care for the safety of others, right, which a reasonably careful person would have used under the same or similar circumstances. So, you know, if you put it in a different scenario, a doctor, there's a certain standard of care that a doctor would use. If a reasonably careful doctor would have done this and this doctor didn't, that would be negligence. Or a driver. Drivers are under a duty to use due care due to the nature of driving an automobile. So if a reasonably careful driver would act in this way and you act in less than that, you fail to do that, then that could be considered simple negligence. So that's not a huge hurdle, but the real issue is that the action must not only be negligent, but also be the cause of the death. So that means that the death of these individuals, or these sailors who died, has to have been the natural and probable result of the accused's negligence. And that's where it gets difficult.
So I could make the case that, yes, he was negligent, but there was all these other factors that contributed to their death that he had no control over. Therefore, while he is negligent, he's not, he shouldn't be found guilty of negligent homicide because of all these other factors.
And there's a part of the instruction that talks about when there's multiple people or multiple causes of the injury or death to the victim, and it says it's possible for the conduct of two or more persons to contribute to the death of another. But so if the person who is on trial, if their conduct was a direct cause of the victim's death, then just because somebody else did something that also contributed to the death won't relieve you of criminal liability. However, if there was some sort of unforeseeable, independent, or intervening cause which led to the death, then the person charged is not guilty of negligent homicide. So, for example, if it turns out that the crew members died because nobody sounded an alarm warning them of the impending collision, and therefore they were in their beds asleep, and that action of not sounding an alarm can't be traced to the CO, then is that the reason they died, because of where they were on the ship as opposed to because of the collisions of the ship? Or, you know, so it's, that'll be interesting to see when the charges become public themselves, the wording of the charge, what the action, what the negligent act or failure to act is, it's alleged, and how far that would go to actually showing itself to be, you know, that basically that those sailors, once that action or failure to act occurred, there was really no other probable result other than the death of these sailors. That's difficult.
The let me just walk through. I've got a question. Let me do an email first, and then I just want to walk through a few of the cases historically. The Navy has not charged. The article that I'm reading says the Navy has not court-martialed a ship's captain following a deadly mishap since the destroyer USS Kincaid and the Panama-flagged freighter MV Cotopaxi collided in the Straits of Malacca on November 12, 1989, killing one naval officer aboard the Kincaid and injuring 17 sailors. In that case, the ship's captain, John Cochran, commander type, faced charges of dereliction of duty and negligence, but was acquitted after defense attorneys argued that he could not be held criminally liable because his crew never informed him that the ship was in danger. Like Benson on the Fitzgerald, he was asleep at the time of the crash. In a more recent case involving loss of life, the submarine USS Greenville collided with the Japanese fishing vessel Ihai Maru as it surfaced off the coast of Hawaii on February 9, 2001. The ship sank within minutes, killing four high school students, two teachers, and three crew members. The Navy ultimately determined the presence of 16 civilian guests on the submarine at the time was a distraction, but decided that a court-martial was not warranted. The submarine's captain, Commander Scott Waddle, was instead found guilty of dereliction of duty and negligent hazarding at an administrative hearing known as Admiral's Mast and allowed to retire with full benefits. And then there's three cases that people see similarities to. November 22nd, 1975, collision between the guided missile cruiser Belknap and the USS John F. Kennedy, which is an aircraft carrier. Eight service members were killed, 48 injured on the Belknap as it suffered catastrophic damage. Jet fuel in some kind of line that was on the exterior of the ship was ruptured, poured into the Belknap, and ignited, igniting the Belknap. The Navy court-martialed Captain Walker Schaefer, the captain of the Belknap, and Captain William A. Gurick, the captain of the Kennedy, but acquitted both. The service found that the officer on the deck of the Belknap, Lieutenant J.G. Kenneth Null, guilty of negligence and disregarding a standing order, but did not impose a punishment. So you get some kind of sense of the burden relative to the prosecution to prove these trials. In other like cases, the Navy has not prosecuted nearly as aggressively. So very, very interesting, I think.
Well, yes, it is, and I think it's also interesting that they've charged, despite what appears to have been different involvement by the COs in these two different incidents. So, you know, as you said, the Fitzgerald, the CO was asleep, and the McCain, the CO was on the bridge. So, the fact that they've charged both of them in, you know, aside from it being collisions at sea, what seem to be maybe different types of incidents with the same charge is, again, interesting to see if they think it's a common, you know, failure to act or action that has to do with training or supervision, or if there's just something they found in each of those cases, specific to those cases, if they believe the course I charge. That'll be interesting to see too.
Yeah. The let me read you an email, and I want to come back to that. Mac, to what extent do the larger operational problems of the Navy contribute to this, and will they be evidenced in trial? For instance, the crew of one of those two ships went to sea without the appropriate qualifications in navigation and a few other departments, which I'm not sure about. Two, you heard this Senator McCain discuss the 100-hour work week, and then in parentheses, Mac, don't go off on it, whatever you do. Do not go off on the statement. The reason why he says that is when we deploy, and the Marine Corps has done a lot of it, and all of us have done a lot of it, work, if we only worked 100 hours in a week, right, that means you have 10 hours a day free to yourself to go to the gym, to sleep, to eat, whatever. That's not the case. And so when I see Senator McCain stand up and bitch and yell about this 100-hour work week that they work underway, give me a break. I mean, it's ridiculous. But the email goes, that's what he didn't want. We need to go off on it. And I'm not going to go off on it. I just want to articulate. Okay, so the email goes on. So my bottom line is these larger issues in the Navy, will defense attorneys bring those up? Will they bring the CNO, major figures in the Navy, in the 7th Fleet, to account for their operational decisions as well as their cultural decisions? Will all that be on trial here?
Beth? If the defense has their way, it absolutely will. You know, we talked a minute ago about independent, unforeseeable, intervening circumstances, basically right. Things outside of the CO's control that would have caused the death of these sailors. If I was the defense, I'd be arguing that all that stuff represents independent intervening circumstances. And I saw some article too about, you know, the CNO be called. As the judge, I have a hard time believing the judge would okay bringing the CNO in to talk about that, only because you don't need the CNO in to talk about operational tempo or things like that. What I would expect to see would be concerns that the CO had previously raised to his leadership about those types of things. So if that's true, that the crew was unprepared for the deployment or is being overworked in some way that they felt was irresponsible or unsafe, and the COs had previously raised that to their superiors, and that I would absolutely think would be relevant. It doesn't need to go all the way up to a CNO, but certainly, I mean, you had people from the, you know, the 7th Fleet, all, you know, a bunch of them were relieved as a result of these, you know, so I'd be looking to pin it on or to bring in the responsibilities and failures of a bunch of people, and that's the best way to mitigate or to defend against these charges.
It sounds like if you were a defense attorney, that I don't want to say you'd be licking your chops to get at this case, but you certainly would look at it and say, I wouldn't absolutely positively not mind taking this case on, because there's certainly enough low-hanging fruit for me to do what I'm supposed to do and to maybe not exonerate them, either one of the commanding officers, the OD or the JOD, but certainly get this back in the box as opposed to something that's outlandish.
Right. Well, and exactly, as it relates to the negligent homicide charges,
right.
The dereliction charges and the improper hazarding charges,
right.
Again, depending on you know, what the evidence shows, would be more difficult to, I think, to defend against. But yeah, maybe, you know, I mean, the hardest part is going to be, I think, if it ends up going to, the way that the Navy has positioned itself right now is that these are heading towards general court-martial. And a defense attorney may be able to, maybe it's Article 32, knock out the negligent homicide charges, but to get everything down to Admiral's Mast, like the, you know, the USS Greenville CO got or something like that, it's going to be harder based on kind of where we're starting out.
Okay. Another email. Mac, what role do these other historical precedents play? Can the defense attorneys walk in and argue you based on this decision, it belongs here, based on this decision, it should be charged this way? Is that what defense attorneys will do at the Article 32? So, yeah, what role
does... Maybe it's Article 32. Sure. It wouldn't have anything to do with anything. There'd never be a whisper of any of that at a trial.
Okay.
But at the Article 32, because part of the point of that is to recommend the proper forum, the proper disposition, as the defense, I would certainly bring up past cases and show how they were handled much
differently.
More favorable for the officers favorably and sort of try to get a good recommendation out of the preliminary hearing officer. And also, you know, probably submit a lot of information. It's also a good way to get that information in front of the convening authority and his SJA. So I would do it there. Once it gets to trial, none of that comes anywhere near a courtroom. It's just, you know, the trial is about the facts of this particular case and the laws as applied. And what happened to somebody else in some other case has nothing to do with anything. That.
Another email. Mac, interesting program this morning. I did not realize the Navy was reaching as far as it seems as they're reaching in this case. My question is, it seems like the prosecution is in a very, very difficult position here. The nation has watched the Navy repeatedly fail in the Pacific, and I think most expect something will be done. You bring up a good point when you say the Navy cannot afford another setback. I don't envy the prosecutors in this case. It seems like they've already overreached, which does not seem to bode well for the outcome. I'm curious about Lieutenant Colonel Harvey's thoughts about this. Is the prosecution in a tough position? I mean,
well, the prosecution's always in a tough position by nature of the justice system. I mean, that's unless you have an open and shut crime with videotapes or confessions, in any case, the prosecution is, you know, the one with all the work to do. But I don't know if it's fair to say they're overreaching or not. Again, all we have is the tidbits that have been released. Once you see the actual charge and the way it's charged as far as what they allege that the negligent act is, it may become more clear that there are more solid ground. It's just, it is difficult in any negligent homicide charge, most of them, to show that the negligent act is the cause of the death. So In that respect, it's difficult. I don't know if they're overreaching or not, but only they know that right now. But as far as, you know, whether or not they need to show that they're being tough, you know, in some cases, I'm not saying that's the thinking here, but in some cases, preferring the charge and sending it to an Article 32 is sort of considered, you know, a sign of taking that tough action, of putting people on notice that this is taken seriously, of you know, sort of giving that charge its day in court, even though it's not, it's at the preliminary hearing, but and sort of airing it out and seeing if it has any legs. And the Navy may, you know, get a recommendation back to say it does, says it doesn't, and get rid of those charges and go forward on what it does have probable cause to support. And you may consider that all part of, you know, their responsibility to explore the evidence and see what, see what's there. So I'm not sure that they necessarily feel like now that they've announced this, if they don't get a conviction, they'll be seen as having failed everybody. But I think they see all of these actions and employing the process in this way as a demonstration of how seriously they take this and them doing the right thing.
My guest this morning has been Lieutenant Colonel retired Beth Harvey. She's raised by a retired Marine, and so by way of the University of Notre Dame, and which we love here on the program. So we've been talking about kind of the technicalities of charging the case against the commanding officers of the McCain and the Fitzgerald, along with an officer of the deck and a junior officer of the deck, and there's others that are rumored to be pending, as Beth alluded to a while ago. Beth, is there any this is the general question designed after the general article? Is there anything I haven't asked you that you think is important that people know when they look at these cases?
No, I think the important part is just explaining that, I guess, that negligence may be apparent and may be absolutely there, but negligent homicide requires that the death be a natural and probable result of the negligence, and that's something different than just showing the negligence itself. So, I think that's really the interesting part of these cases.
All right. Beth, first of all, I appreciate you taking time for us, as you consistently do, so thank you very much. What's on the schedule for the rest of the day? Anything exciting?
I've got some work to do, and then I've got to finish up my continuing legal education requirements for the state of California. And then dinner.
Sounds like fun. What's for dinner?
Oh, I don't know yet. You have any good ideas?
Well, I mean, it's a nice day here in Southern California, so grilling might not be a bad idea. Maybe a piece of salmon, right?
Maybe
a piece of salmon. Normally, not real expensive, and tastes great. So, that'd be my suggestion: grill salmon.
There you go.
And that way, you don't even have to grill it, right? You can make nut grill it.
That's true.
So you've already cut your labor in half, and you have to make a salad together, maybe some rice, and boom, you're in the front row.
Oh, there we go. All right. Good day.
All right. Anytime I can be of help, don't be afraid to call. All right. Beth, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a good day, Mike.
All right. There you have it. Beth Harvey, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps. Interesting. Interesting. So we'll pay attention to the Article 32 hearings as they unfold. I have to tell you that given the history of, that you read, I think I would prefer to be a defense attorney in this case. I'll read you one more piece from this is a Washington Times article. He's a four-star admiral who retired in 2013. Stavridis? I know I'm butchering the name. Anyway, I've seen the name before. Former four-star admiral, United States Navy. So the Navy's decisions so far show that it wants to hold service members accountable for what has happened. But he acknowledged that the homicide charges in a collision case are very rare and said that the standard for conviction will be high. People involved in the Fitzgerald and McCain incidents, quote, appear to have made significant errors in judgment and will have to face a trial and the consequences if convicted. He is now dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. But there's an additional benefit, he added. carrying out judicial actions now, he said, will hold a high standard of accountability in future disasters, whether they involve aircraft, submarines, Navy, or Navy SEAL operations. You know, I've talked about this. I learned about the role of the SJA when I worked for General Mattis. And in that capacity, I saw investigations into the damage we did to property, killings that were done inadvertently. And, I saw all that stuff. And it became to me very clear the role of the staff judge advocate and why you have to charge these things, because you have to send that message constantly. The fact, I'll tell you what, it seems to me, and I'd be curious to know, the Navy has not charged a commanding officer for a collision since 1989. That's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing when you think about that. So I guess I shake my head when I hear that and I read that, and now saying that they're looking to send a message. I think it speaks to the lack of culture in the Navy that you can go 30 years of vessels, all the mistakes being made with vessels, and nobody be court-martialed for it. Is that what message were you sending for 30 years? So, anyway, Film at 11. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to take you to Quezon. We're going to use Ken Rogers, some audio, a couple audio cuts from him. And I will tell you this. Text your friends. Tell them to turn on All Marine Radio right now, because what you're about to hear is riveting. You're going to hear two segments and then talking about them. And there's a mental health message in here. There's also a Marine message in here about the toughness of these guys. And remember, they got the shit shelled out of them every day for almost 77 days. I tell Rogers, that's why you're not right in the head, bro. That's why I love you. He laughs, but not very much. He says, yeah, no kidding. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We'll go to Quezon through their words coming up next.